Good evening, everyone. Welcome to today's event, Multi-Stakeholder Collaboration in a Digital Age. My name is Professor Lee Edwards. I'm Professor of Strategic Communications and Public Engagement in the Department of Media and Communications here at the LSE. And I'm really delighted to host this panel discussion on the challenges and opportunities of the digital landscape for resolving some of the most pressing and complex problems that we've perhaps ever been faced with. Digital technologies, of course, are often presented as unquestionably positive, indispensable tools that can contribute innovative, inclusive, and engaging avenues for solutions to collective challenges such as climate change, migration, poverty, conflict. And indeed, digital technologies are already used in many of these contexts. But the discussion today takes a step back from putting digital first, because our panelists take the celebration of digital technologies with a bit of a pinch of salt, and instead are going to examine the kinds of environments and relationships that we need to facilitate digital interventions that promote our collective and long-term well-being. Digital initiatives, of course, are always multi-stakeholder, requiring a range of different people and organisations to come together for the purposes of design and development and implementation. And the questions that today's panel will address are focused on the quality of the relationships between those kinds of actors and the parameters within which their work might unfold. So how does a digital landscape for collaboration shape the way we think, the ways we think about collaboration, the risks and opportunities that collaboration affords for resolving complex problems, and how might collaboration itself mitigate the risks that digital interventions can present to communities and individuals? And the discussion takes as its starting point the just released report, Maximizing Business Contributions to Sustainable Development and Positive Peace, a Human Security Approach. The report's authored by Mary Martin of LSE Ideas, who is also our first speaker today. And Dr. Martin's going to reflect on the key findings in the report and set the scene for the discussion. She'll be followed by Damien Collins, MP, who's been heavily involved with the development of the Online Safety Bill here in the UK, and will consider how policy and regulation can facilitate multi-stakeholderism in an evolving digital landscape, its impact on the relationships between government, business and civil society, and the challenges of ensuring protection for citizens and users, including the most vulnerable. Stefan Borst will then follow. He's head of Edelman's Global Advisory for Europe and CEO of Edelman Brussels. Stefan will consider the complexities and opportunities inherent in demands for business to be a trustworthy collaborator and responsible partner, particularly when using digital technologies to provide solutions to social challenges. And our final panelist, Peter Majcek, General Counsel and UN Policy Manager at Access Now, will reflect on the parameters that need to be in place to protect civil society interests in the context of multi-stakeholder collaborations, ensuring that ethical practices and norms underpin the processes that they promote. So each speaker will speak for around 7 minutes, and we'll then ask the panel to briefly respond to each other's contributions before opening up to questions from the audience. Please do ask any questions that you have via the Q&A button. With that, I'd like to thank again the panelists, all our panelists, for joining us. I'll hand over to Mary Martin, our first speaker.
Thank you very much, Lee, and welcome to everybody who's here tonight. As Lee mentioned, the context for this evening's discussion is the report that we've just produced. We produced it for the UN. I say we because you'll be glad to know it was a collective endeavour. Many stakeholders were involved from the private sector, from civil society, and from international public sector. And what we wanted to look at in the report, which has gone to the UN Secretary General, is about the need for collective action to address some of the big global challenges we currently face. Obviously, the pandemic, but also climate change and the technological revolution itself. And all these crises, these sort of inflection points, are changing the ways we work and live. You'll find a link to the report in the chat box, so hopefully you can go into it in more detail. But what we mean by collective action, particularly from the point of view of this report, was that business, the private sector, which isn't perhaps traditionally the main actor that gets involved in social and political challenges, but it means business has to work with government and civil society. And to be clear what I mean by business, because sometimes we think only in terms of large corporations, global companies and so on, but business, of course, means all kinds of organizations that work in the private sector, from small and medium-sized companies, entrepreneurs, business associations, and so on. And the point that we were trying to make in the report is that all of these have a role and responsibility in helping to resolve the social problems that we face at the moment. It's not easy. Clearly, it's difficult, particularly for non-traditional actors like the private sector, to come into these conversations. It requires a different mindset and different ways of working to emphasize things like participation, partnering, trust building, listening and understanding what others want and expect. And this is sometimes very far from what particularly companies are used to, which may be bargaining and negotiation. And the phrase we use a lot in the report is the importance of the co-construction of outcomes, the solutions that we want to see to these really pressing global challenges of our time, are outcomes that are arrived at by people working together and seeing them all having a responsibility for how these pan out. And specifically in the report, we do two things. We argue for a human security approach by business to these global challenges. And what does that mean? Well, human security is perhaps a very academic term, but it's about looking at challenges from the perspective of people and their everyday lives. It's a holistic approach because it recognizes that most of us, and particularly the most vulnerable, not only face multiple threats, and these are all interconnected. So, for example, in the current pandemic, we know that COVID not only attacks physical health, mental health, but also livelihoods and education all at the same time. So that's the interconnection. And that these sort of challenges, like COVID and others, require comprehensive rather than single solutions. But human security is also about working from the ground up so that the solutions you devise are solutions that people are involved in working out for themselves with others, not ones that are foisted on them, which tend to not work and certainly not last in the long term. Apart from human security, the second thing the report does is look at where this kind of collective multi-stakeholder approach based on human security can have real impact, looking at certain issue areas. You know, where should business perhaps think about engaging? Where should there be multi-stakeholder efforts where perhaps there haven't been in the past? And one of these is digital technology. And why did we choose that? I'm going to make a sort of circular argument here that's really, I think, at the heart of this panel's discussion. Firstly, information communication technology obviously makes it technically more possible and easier to collaborate across different interest groups, geographical and cultural spaces and time zones, and it facilitates new conversations. One example we use in the report is something called that happened in Liberia and Western Africa, called the Ebola Private Sector Mobilization Group. When Ebola broke out in 2014 in West Africa, a lot of private sector companies working in the area came together, and they came together to share information, to share logistics and resources, and to step in at a time when the traditional actors like World Health Organization or governments were really not focused on the severity of the crisis. The companies, because they were operating on the ground, could see the effects. And really it started off as a kind of massive conference call with up to 400 companies participating. But it was a good example of where digital technology was the dynamizer for an intense and very productive collaboration to respond to that crisis. But as Lee mentioned in her introduction, with this possibility of technology comes all sorts of ethical challenges. Who controls these new kinds of conversations and spaces? Are they really inclusive or equitable? And is the way that technology is being deployed, does it undermine democracy and in fact create new power structures which make the problems we've seen with COVID and are seeing with climate change, problems of vulnerability, fragility, inequity, does it make them actually worse rather than better? And going back to the human security approach, how much are ordinary users of technology, people, at the heart of how the technology is being developed and deployed? And I think this matters in the context of collective action, because we need to create new norms, whether through policy and regulation or through direct action, social activism, or through changes, voluntary changes in behavior, particularly by the private sector, to make sure that multi-stakeholder action doesn't become some kind of Trojan horse that ends up giving the already powerful more power, creating more unbalanced economies in the end. And finally, that links to the other reason we think there's an interesting intersection between particularly information communication technology and collective action. That we need, as Lee mentioned, we need more collective action, we need multi-stakeholder interventions to establish those new norms, to shape the digital landscape in ways that work for everyone. So that's what I mean by a circular argument. Digital technology can promote and support a multi-stakeholder universe, but we need to deploy that universe much more systematically to ensure that the rapid developments in particularly in ICT and other digital technologies don't just remain in the hands of the few, but that all companies, investors, society, stand to gain in as many as equal ways as possible. So I'll leave it there and look forward to the discussion.
Thanks, Mary. Many challenges in just 6 minutes of presentations already. There's lots to think about. Let's move to Damien. Damien, over to you.
Thank you very much. I think it's a very important discussion, because when we were considering the Joint Select Committee's reports on the Online Safety Bill, one of the key issues we had to grapple with that was really fundamental to the whole approach is to what extent laws that Parliament has passed and that courts have interpreted and acted upon in order to keep people safe, the extent to which they apply in an online world, where that online world is not just a narrow and discrete thing, it really touches everything. And the gap that is broken, it's almost as if in some ways that we have devolved, or rather like you devolve government, we've devolved power of decision-making to two big tech companies, because they've been allowed to write the rules that govern the spaces that millions and billions of people every day and every month choose to spend a large part of their time. And the question we have to ask is, left unchecked, well, that creates a whole range, not only of unsafe spaces for people, but actually will it create an environment where laws and regulatory bodies and safety mechanisms that we've created for the offline world don't work in the online one? And what happens in those spaces is determined by the companies that have created those spaces, spaces that they've created ultimately to make money for themselves. Now, I think, having this discussion and this debate, it does not mean you are anti-technology. There's no doubt that technology has created enormous advantages in terms of people's access to information, ability to communicate and engage with other people and with other forms of content that just wouldn't be accessible to them. But I think if you think about the way in which these safety systems work in the online world, it's a question, I think, rather like we've addressed in other industries, that safety standards were created in response to known risks. I think having seatbelts in cars is a good thing. It doesn't make me anti-car. I think that having regulations around product testing for new pharmaceutical products doesn't make me doubt or question the expertise or the initiative of the big pharma companies. It's a safety requirement that makes sense, in the same way we ask oil companies to have certain safeguards in place to protect the planet from pollution from the extraction of oil and gas. So I think we're in a similar space with technology, and I'll give you some examples of what I mean, why I think this is important. Firstly, we should question, if you take something like online fraud, It's very difficult to take enforcement action on fraud online when the criminal offence is seen as being committed by the person posting fraud content, but the platform that they use to distribute that content has no particular liability for it at all. Even if you're placing an advert for a known scam on Facebook, there's no requirement that Facebook shouldn't accept that advertising or should take it down. There's no law that says that they have to do that. To what extent do users really have agency or the ability to control the spaces that they're in online when so much of what they see and experience is selected for them by the algorithms of the platforms? Over 70% of what people watch on YouTube, they don't search for. The Facebook news feed is a curated feed of content selected by the platform. We heard a lot of testimony on child safety on the online environment, where they talk about the fact that, you know, on TikTok content, when you go to TikTok for you, you see a range of content which the platform has selected for you. If you try and search for something on Instagram, before you type anything in, you see a range of options that Instagram thinks you're interested in even before you search for them. Now, if that's interest in music or holiday destinations, then where's the harm in that? But what if that content is glamorizing self-harm or promoting extreme dieting or promoting hate speech or extremist ideas and opinions? You know, is that healthy? Is that good? And what agency and power do people have to even stop it in that environment? When we look at the rise of cryptocurrency as a method of payment, you know, how will the sort of financial oversight we have both to sustain the value of currencies through reserve, you know, capital reserve requirements that banks have, how will they exist in a digital world of cryptocurrency? If major platforms like Facebook had their own currency, what would we do if people decided that they would get paid, you know, unknown amounts through that currency and trading it online? How would the government have the ability to understand what people earn and what taxes they're liable for if it can't see any of that information? How would we clamp down on money laundering if there were no disclosure requirements for transactions through platforms that use cryptocurrency as well? I think we'll see in the competition space the question of, if major platforms like, say, Amazon or Google or Facebook are totally integral to the ability of a company to reach its own customers and audience, to what extent do they have fair access to those platforms? There was a case we looked at when I was chair of the Digital Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee that showed how Mark Zuckerberg himself made an arbitrary decision to close off access to Facebook user data for the app Vine, which effectively killed it as a product. Where companies have a strategy to identify popular apps and products that their customers are using on their platforms, and on that basis make decisions to acquire them or to effectively shut them down. If you launch a popular product on a retail platform, like Amazon, they could see whether, if you're doing well, they should launch their own copycat product and de-rank yours and promote theirs heavily and aggressively. To what extent are these anti-competitive practices legitimate, and should they be regulated as they would be in the offline world? So we have to consider how the regulators that we've created to keep people safe, to deal with corruption, to give certainty to the value of financial products and services, prevent fraud, how are they enforced if a larger part of this activity is taking place in a walled garden that we can't see into? So if we talk about cooperation in the space, it has to ultimately be underpinned, in my opinion, by legislation, by statute, because the world as exists today is the one the companies have created for themselves. There's as much oversight and enforcement of their terms of service as they want there to be. And they've, in many cases, they hide behind the idea that they are neutral platforms, free of liability for what anyone does on their systems, even though those systems have been designed to make money for them. And I think that is why we're seeing in the UK, you know, the new approach to safety through the Online Safety Act, I think probably the most far forward looking and wide ranging piece of legislation in the world, and why we're looking at legislating to empower the Competition and Markets Authority to look at some of these other issues around fair access to markets and fair trading and abuse of market power, as the EU is doing through the Digital Services Act, the Digital Markets Act, as Australia is doing through the reforms to empower the e-safety commissioner in Australia. And we're seeing, you know, a series of initiatives in the United States Congress looking at ending the freedom from liability of tech companies for what happens on their spaces. So I think we are moving into this new world. It is partly about cooperation, but cooperation based on terms set by national parliaments and governments, based on the law and a requirement for companies to meet certain objectives and standards that so far they haven't been prepared to meet. And I think what we'll see is a leveling up of approach where what works in some countries will be copied in others. But the problem we have to solve is to say that when so much of people's time is spent in an unregulated space, how do we then seek to regulate that? And if we look at that to the near future and the development of technologies like the metaverse, when probably sooner than we think, people will be able to enjoy an immersive experience that is barely indistinguishable from the real world. How do we make sure that people are kept safe in those environments, and who has the right to see and who has the right to act? And what we can't allow is for all those decisions to be devolved to the companies that have created those spaces to make money.
Thanks, Damien. You bring up a whole range of different issues there in relation to, you know, the realities of the digital space itself being a very active shaper of our interactions. And of course, those natural business dynamics that are part of the business world, the competition, the self-interest, the drive to kind of create a space that you can operate best in. All of those things are going to be really important, I think, in this kind of multi-stakeholder collaboration space. And Stefan is our next speaker, and perhaps appropriately, you're coming from the business perspective. So I over to you, Stefan, to give us another set of thinking around that area.
Thank you very much, Lee. That was quite a fascinating tour de force through a lot of aspects that are extremely interesting. Indeed, I'm looking at this digital world from a business perspective, because we mostly work for businesses who have to now work in a completely different fashion than they used to. It was much easier in the past. You either had a service or a product that was competitive in price, useful for your clients or your customers. It may have been trendy, that's why people bought it, or more usable, anything like that. The question that was never asked back then is, what good does your product do to society? And in our recent trust barometer, actually, when we looked at basically trust globally in the perspective, and the very interesting and a little bit shocking result was that in terms of trust, people trust business more than governments, NGOs, or the media to be able to cope with today's societal issues. But that has a flip side for businesses. Businesses need to focus more than ever before on the question is, what are we doing as a company, and what are products doing for the betterment of society, or the benefit of society, of saving the planet, or saving society, or changing societal developments that are negative. This is particularly true for digital companies who claim, and I'm very much in the line of what Damien said, they claim neutrality, but in fact, who governs or ensures that this neutrality is really, really safeguarded and truly neutral? So at this point in time, we face the challenge, or businesses face the challenge, that they, on the one hand side, have to change their approach, how to talk about their business, how to talk about their products and services, and to whom and how, which channels they use to do so. Because in the past, it was enough if you talk to your customers or if you talk to politicians when it was about a regulation. These days, the whole field has completely flattened out. And I always like to take this as an example. This is one of the last remaining products of a single-use plastic straw. It's a product that is very usable. It's very helpful in doing the job that it's designed for. It has a nice color to it. Unfortunately, usually you use it once, you throw it away, it ends up in the oceans. Now, that was picked up by activists, filmed, and through the internet, through digital means, was picked up by NGOs, and then entered the broader public and created that much of a political pressure on legislators that in record time, the EU pushed through a legislation that effectively bans single-use plastic products. So you can see that however the company producing these was prepared to deal with a potential issue, they were absolutely not prepared for the massive flood of complaints and activism and outreach and challenges they were facing through this digital tsunami that was rolling towards them. And before they even got their act together, the legislation was through. And that is one of the key ingredients today. When you look at multi-stakeholder approaches in the digital age, the challenges are global. It's very hard to limit certain things to only one region or only one particular place. The speed of how issues actually develop is mind-bogglingly fast. So you need to be really aware of everything that is going on, and you need to have the right tools and mechanisms in place to react if something is actually happening. And the relevant stakeholders that really matter to you may not be the ones you're used to. It may not be your local politician. It may not be the national politician in that respect, or your customers. It could be a completely different group that you have no access to, that you do not understand, and that operates in ways you cannot really tap into. For one example, nowadays, everyone around the globe, when they open a website, are confronted with a little pop-up that says, are you okay with our cookie policy? It happens in the United States. That legislation was not developed in the United States. It was developed in Brussels. It's a result of the GDPR. So as a matter of fact, a lot of millions spent in Washington, D.C. on lobbying on this would have been better invested in Brussels. But that's not how we are used to perceive these kind of problems, these ripple effects of regulatory hubs like Brussels or Beijing or Washington, D.C., are rarely understood at a global level. And that is what really has to change, and where digital in particular has leveled the playing field completely. And the last thing I want to point out, this is a two-way street. So you can communicate through the digital means with a wide range of stakeholders, but they can communicate back in a way that was unprecedented, is unprecedented, and upping the stakes that are at play if you look at it from a global perspective. That was my part to that, and now I'm handing back to Lee.
Thanks very much, Stefan. A global landscape, indeed. And appropriately, we're going to go to New York. I think it's New York, isn't it? Where Peter Majcak, our last panelist, is. Peter, over to you.
Yeah, thanks so much. Yeah, I think this is raising a number of big issues. I tend to think in terms of examples and anecdotes, my daily work. You know, we do a lot of activism, and we work with a lot of activists at Access Now, and through our RightsCon event series. And so, yeah, forgive me if I do lead by example. I think there are a few points I wanted to make off the top. One is that the tech can often be invisible until it's a problem. And the tech keeps people invisible if it's not, you know, adequately available, and if they didn't have a role in co-creating it. And you know, I think a lot of the early tech, with respect to the MP's comments, yeah, most of the businesses we know these days, when we think of the tech sector, right, are corporations formed to make money, as he said repeatedly. But we didn't start that way on the internet, and I don't think we'll end that way. And in the meantime, there are a lot of great properties out there that people are using for all sorts of good. And those institutions, you know, the Wikimedias, the Mozillas, of the world, you know, need to be sustained they need stakeholders to come to their rescue often when, you know, proposals are put forward that might have unintended consequences. And I think that's you know, another one of the points I wanted to make is that when it comes to regulating tech, there are always unintended consequences because this is, you know, an online ecosystem that's constantly evolving, and that due to the beauty of this, you know, internet that we've created, has, you know, endpoints that are reachable no matter where you are, you know, and Yeah, so it's really baked into the design of the system that when you tinker with some of the rules over here, they're going to have impacts over here. And it's only through, you know, co-creation and involving stakeholders, you know, from the start, and really looking broadly, as we've heard other speakers say, at the potential, you know, categories of potential types of different stakeholders that might be impacted by a decision, that we're going to co-create something that's that is safe and that is sustainable. So, you know, looking at the state of internet access, and I think inclusivity in the SDGs is really a thrust of the report. You know, we saw 800 million people or so come online between 2019 and 2021, which is pretty good, as Doreen Bogdan-Martin reports from the ITU. Most of the 17 global goals were thrust sharply off track by the force of the pandemic, which has highlighted and exacerbated the crippling cost of digital exclusion. So we have 800 million new people coming online, but we still have you know, an even sharper cost, right, for those who are unable to really fully exercise their rights and pursue their interests in a digital space. And so I do want to bring it back to connectivity, because I think, you know, being in a goal 17 or goal 9C, you know, being seen as a cross-cutting goal often means that you'll fall in the cracks, and you won't put, you know, meaningful, robust, open connectivity at the forefront. And I think too often policymakers have kind of assumed that the telecom companies, maybe, you know, pursuing their own interests, would bring everyone online. And that's just not the way it's going to work to bring the next billion, you know, who are often purposefully excluded online. So I do want to put that forward, that the tech can be invisible and it keeps people invisible if they don't have access. We need to keep it front of mind, even if it's not the main issue you work on. And then I think there's a lot of talk about building relationships, you know, throughout this report and panel so far we've heard. And yes, consultation, you know, has been lacking all too much, all too often. You know, these standards have been put together, these products and services built without, you know, really talking to the folks on the front line who are going to be impacted. That's why my organization created this conference, RightsCon, where we bring all stakeholders together to you know, put frontline activists and human rights defenders face to face with, you know, those money-minded corporates as well as policymakers, to hash out consensus, to forge new norms, and to really give that feedback on how the tech is being used, before and against our communities. But, you know, some caveats around consultation processes: that feedback fatigue is real. You know, if you really do reach out to your stakeholder groups at every stage of creation, you need to think of, you know, the equities that are at stake there. And as you get to the most vulnerable, and if you start talking about fragile and conflict affected states, right, those people don't have a lot of time on their hands. They don't have a lot of connectivity. They don't have a lot of money to spend, you know, buying the data plans that get them onto these video calls, right, where these consultations might be happening. And that's doubly true during the crises themselves. And so these relationships should be formed before crises, and they should be maintained in sustainable ways that don't overburden, you know, again, those most likely to be impacted by the tech or by anything else, the crises we're talking about. And then, you know, the last point I want to make, you know, put the tech front of mind. The relationships do matter more, but you know, the tech is not something that that you should take your eye off of. I think, given that, you know, tech regulations always have these broad impacts, it is important to bring technologists along to understand, you know, how these things are going to play out. When it comes to Ebola, the example that was used, you know, I think people realized data could hold a potential to show the way forward, but there was really, you know, kind of an ugly scramble from, you know, a lot of Western institutions, including like really well-meaning folks like hospitals and such, to get access to, you know, telecom data, call records, trying to map human migration and mobility, for example, to map the crisis, say, to target their interventions effectively. But privacy is a fundamental right, and there were some fights and a lot of tension around the request to hand over all of this data wholesale without actually considering the secondary impacts, without any consent, right, from those on the ground whose data was being tossed around. So that also led to some good I think developments in terms of principles around crisis that I think could inform the kind of human security approach that that is proposed here. As far as other examples, I think we've been focusing a lot on Myanmar, on Telenor's attempt to exit that market. This is a place where I think we told the telecom companies that were bidding and around 2013 that they should plan for something to go wrong. They should plan for the worst. We didn't know exactly when or what form it would take, but it is really disheartening to see this company pulling out in a way that is breaking a lot of the relationships that were formed with civil society. It's showing a worst case scenario where civil society is powerless, and even to the extent that we exist, we don't feel safe necessarily engaging with other stakeholders in that region, where the company is really the primary duty holder and perhaps the last resort, keeping a military regime from people's sensitive data. We've just seen reports that people's accounts information and data is being extracted through torture on the ground. And it's a place where the company really, again, is kind of the last domino standing in defense of people's digital rights, which are intimately connected with fundamental dignities and essential interests like physical safety. So that scenario, again, one where I think relationships were built up, but that when worst comes to worst, the company is looking out for itself, looking out for its employees, as you might expect, and its assets, and not really proceeding in a way that we would consider human-centric when it comes to their users at risk and those most vulnerable people in the environment. So a difficult case study there, and hopefully one that sparks more discussion. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Peter. That's a really interesting contribution to conclude the panel. It brings up so many of the really difficult complexities, I think, of multi-stakeholder collaboration as set out in the report. The need to, as you say, kind of start from the bottom up, and to really kind of engage people who are in those spaces to understand what they need, rather than simply assuming, for example, in the Ebola crisis, oh, well, data will fix it, so we'll just go in and do loads of data collection, do loads of tracking and mapping, and surely that will be okay. And of course, then, the Myanmar example, an awful example, but really illustrative of, you go into a partnership, it has to be long term, there has to be some kind of fundamental commitment, not just in terms of business, but also in terms of kind of humanity and morality there. I think the other thing that your comments bring in, of course, going back to Stefan and Damien's contributions, is this kind of the world of the digital and the promise that it offers, but the reality that those digital spaces are fluid and flexible, and that they're different to the concrete materialities that we live in day to day. They're different from the road, where that space can suddenly be taken away from us. And so when we're thinking about that multi-stakeholder collaboration kind of world, when we're merging digital with, as the way of resolving material circumstances, I think that, that synthesis is something that is really potentially quite problematic as well as quite promising. Those tensions are really, really tricky. I'd like to hand back to Mary as the author of the, or the leader of the team who put together the report. If you want to respond to any of the contributions, Mary, before we open up to a broader discussion.
Lots of fascinating strands, and I'm sure those of you who work very much in this kind of digital and the reform space around digital know much better than me all the different directions this can go in. But I wanted to pick up on a phrase that Damien used first, and then I think was echoed by both Stefan and Peter in different ways. And that's the idea of user agency, and you know, where is the user in all this? I think to start a stage earlier, I mean, maybe we're all, and I include myself, we're all slightly guilty of making the assumption that multi-stakeholder is a good thing. You know, if we have collective endeavors to try and fix some of these problems, including the emerging digital landscape, then that by itself is good. But it's only good, as I sort of mentioned in my opening remarks, if you acknowledge that there are two things going on with that and with that assumption. One is that there is a power imbalance. When you're talking about companies, whether it's tech companies or any other company that uses technology or any other company in its sphere of operations, that companies, rather like governments, have so much more resource, not just money, but logistics and information and political clout than the people who they are impacting. And I spend a lot of my time, basically what our project, our research project in LSE Ideas is about, is trying to help move along the mindset of companies to get a kind of behavioral change. And you can deal with companies, whatever sector they're in, whether it's the tech, the big tech companies, the extractives, you know, consumer groups, and they will tell you any number of good initiatives they're doing, consultations, participatory engagements, and so on. But you never alter that underlying fact. And particularly in the areas I work, where it tends to be fragile and conflict, crisis-affected ones, where the inequity is even stronger. So this idea of where is the user, where is the agency of the people who are impacted by this? And I think Peter and Stefan talked very much about the relationships, but those relationships are important in this multi-stakeholder endeavor. But if they are unbalanced relationships, then you're no better off. And when we were doing the chapter on the digital technology, I mean, what I found so striking was that for the tech companies in particular, because of the nature of their product and also the way they're organized, by definition, they are very remote from the people who are using their products, particularly if you're talking about people in developing countries. So, you know, again, we had the example when COVID came along. I was working with a Colombian government. The first thing they wanted to do was to ramp up a digital strategy to connect the rural areas. But of course, along with that comes actually increased harms. You know, the fact that there were some people in the community who had access, were there, as it were, in the front line, being connected and being able to influence or speak back, actually in a very fragile backdrop, made them less safe, not more safe, and the whole community suffered. So I suppose long way around of saying, but how, particularly Damien, how do you feel about your chances of improving user agency through legislation? Or does it require a much more heavy-handed approach even than that, in the sense of treating this as a human rights abuse potentially? You know, that also that whole discourse of business and human rights is now going much more in the direction of kind of hard legislation and treaty. We'll see whether it gets there. But I wonder whether the legislative tack, and particularly the process that you've initiated, for example, with the Online Safety Bill, are you just talking to the big companies? How easy and realistic is it really to focus on the people who are going to be impacted and affected day to day in every sense, as Peter reminded us, in a kind of physical safety and a kind of dignity and a general empowerment sense? So, you know, that was my question, I guess, about the, you know, what's the best route to follow in all this to make sure that we realize the potential of collective action, multi-stakeholder, but just don't get ourselves in an even bigger hole where people are more disadvantaged than before.
Damien, would you like to?
Yeah, thank you. Well, again, I sort of look at, I think you can do that through setting standards in legislation, and the online safety regime really, and it's as set out in the draft bill, and certainly in the amendments we recommended being made in the joint select committee's scrutiny of the bill. At the heart of it is something really quite simple, which is to say that that what is illegal offline should be regulated online, and the job of the regulator is to explain to companies what their obligations are, to set the minimum standards we think they should meet. So those minimum standards are not written by them; they're set out by an independent regulator empowered by Parliament, the government, and that as a consequence of that, the user experience will be better. Now, when I get in, when I get in my car, I have user agency to the extent that I decide where I drive it, but I don't really have much. I don't have any real control over how well it runs, you know, or whether it's safely built. You know, but I don't know how to build a car, therefore I can't determine whether it's been well built or not. But there are safety regulations that have been put in place to make sure certain standards have been followed, and I think that's what we can do here as well, which is to say that there are minimum standards which are there to keep people safe and to mitigate risk. I mean, we have with the gambling industry and with financial services products, regulators take a view as to whether new products are too risky and therefore represent something that is unfair and unsafe for the likely user of that product and service. The government in the UK is consulting, for example, on whether loot boxes in video games should be regulated like gambling products. They are in Holland and Belgium, but not in the UK, because users aren't aware of the spend and the risk and reward relationship that they're engaging with. So I saw in Washington State in America, they've now introduced mandatory sandbox trials for facial recognition technologies. Those trials have to be done by an independent body before a new product can go to market. So we're starting to see a little bit of that in the tech space too. So I think that is how we can rebuild user agency by placing obligations on the platforms in terms of minimum safety standards and making sure that they're met, and having independent oversight about how they work. And I think that will create a better environment. The regulator could in that environment also say that, you know, one of the ways in which a company could do that would be to minimize the level of risk or give better options to users within those systems as well. So whether you could have more options and more power to block certain sorts of content that you didn't want to see, to opt out of certain design features of the product. And that could be a way in which you give through user agency, you try and improve the user experience. But I think a regulatory system can do that. It's not all about saying, here are the rules. If you break the rules, you get fined. It's also about saying, well, actually, how can we ensure that there is a better and safer experience where users will be able to make better choices about how they use the service, as well as setting some minimum safety standards as well.
Thanks, Damien. Stefan and Peter, I don't know whether either of you would like to respond as well to that kind of broad question of user agency. Stefan?
I actually would like to, because there are a couple of more, let's say, behavioral, psychological aspects to be taken into account. Because the same person operates on different digital channels, digital platforms. Like in real life, when we operate in different environments, our behavior changes with the environment. So the behavior of users on Twitter is not the behavior of the same user on Facebook, and not the same behavior as on another account. Now, if you then take into account that these platforms utilize different business models to get the currency they thrive off, and the currency is interaction. The interaction always is linked to something, and unfortunately in the past, and that is I think one of the big parts why Damien's work is so important, the way we humans interact most quickly is when we're annoyed or angry or disgusted or have some sort of strong emotional reaction. And I think one crucial part in what regulators really need to look at is the business model behind making interaction the actual currency of digital business, digital media. Because in the end, it's like what gets clicks will be written and will be put out there. So if you really want to, let's say, make the online environment safer and better, you also have to look at the business models that underlie them. And the second point I wanted to make is more directed towards the reason why it is so difficult for companies, for example, to gauge stakeholder behavior is exactly that, because these stakeholders are multifold. So even a parliamentarian like Damien, for example, he's a political stakeholder first and foremost for me if I approach him. So I need to have a certain set of information for him to understand my cause, and it better be helpful for his dossier. But he's probably also a father, I don't know that, I suspect it, and probably has a hobby where he hangs out with friends and exchanges information there. So he will have different environments that influence his opinion or his reality as well. And unfortunately, the internet requires us to make our approach now more holistic, which has a good side, because of course that there are positive effects in that, but also a very negative side, because it gets very manipulative, and it can be, with the help of artificial intelligence, get manipulative to a level that is really unhealthy for society.
Thanks, Stefan. Some interesting warnings there as well. Peter, over to you.
Yeah, thanks. I think the car analogies are nice. I think the idea of seatbelts is something that we can agree on. We should make available to everyone, right, who's engaging on online, basic, built-in by design options, and teach them how to use those and incentivize those as we center on those options that we can all agree are in everyone's best interest. But even seatbelts themselves, right? There are some scenarios where you might be better off without using one. And that's the thing about the online spaces, as I was saying, is that you can't actually plan for every scenario, that context does matter, that there are some times when those end-to-end encrypted conversations or those dark web spaces are actually the safest place for people to interact. If you're talking about domestic violence victims, and those unintended consequences of well-meaning measures like SESTA FOSTA in the US, this sex trafficking rules that did carve out of our immunity from liability regime under Section 230, those have had those unintended consequences of leaving a lot of sex workers, right? Presumably some of the main constituents intended to be supported by this carve out, leaving those sex workers without ability to screen potential clients, to learn more, to distance themselves from potential harm through online barriers. Again, you really need to work with these, the target communities, and not just simply act because you have one loud voice in your ear, as can be the case. This isn't meant to hamstring policymakers. We absolutely agree there are ways forward, but more so than focusing on the content or the kind of downstream, what you see, we do try to bring the attention further upstream to the business models of these companies, onto the data that they're collecting, the profiles that they're putting together, and the fuel for those AI engines that they run on, right, which is personal information. And And again in this space, you know, we want to see more enforcement. We want to see the average user know where and how to contact their local data protection authority, you know, and that's the kind of seatbelt, having that option there that they're aware of and they can really access in a real way is that kind of user level, intervention. But, that's for everyone. But, you know, again, in the online space, you will need, you know, there are crises that precipitate where people aren't able to, reach out to their local DPA or something. And the Telenor example, just today, there was filed in Norway a general data protection regulation complaint alleging that, you know, Telenor is not upholding, you know, its duties and certainly not best practice in terms of data protection and handing over its Myanmar users' data to the buyer. In that case, you know, some entity that we think is connected to the Myanmar military and the regime, you know, suddenly just purchasing everyone's personal data does not, to us, you know, align with the principles of the general of data protection generally. But those people in Myanmar cannot walk to the local, you know, Norway data protection authorities. So there are, you know, those places where we need to, you know, listen to those stakeholders and act, you know, even when they can't themselves reach for that seatbelt.
I guess that kind of brings us back to this idea of the human security approach, which is very much grounded in specific context. So there might be principles that one would argue should be universal principles in terms of, you know, your rights when you're dealing with data, when you're dealing with a digital context, you know, when and how can you protect your data, when and how can you act in, you know, in relation to the businesses that you're working with. And I wonder whether there's lots of questions that kind of come into my mind about the specific multi-stakeholder context, but we do have a question that kind of relates to what you've been talking about in the Q&A. And please do add more questions in the Q&A if you're in the audience and you have some kind of filtering through your mind. But Isabel Ebert asked, and I think this relates to something that you said earlier on, Mary, but anybody could really answer this because it's an open question about norms. Could you please clarify which type of new norms you're referring to and how they relate to existing frameworks such as human rights and business and human rights? So there's a link in there to the Harvard AI ethics initiative that's there as well. So Mary, would you like to respond to that first, and then anybody else who would like to reflect on that, please do.
Yes, thank you. I think that's a really, I mean, it was something that was certainly bubbling up in my mind. So thank you for that question, because, what new norms? I suppose the norms we're talking about are a mixture of how the digital space is used, by whom. It's kind of overarching questions for this panel. You know, who's controlling these spaces? How do we get user agency in there so that it doesn't just reproduce new kind of unequal power structures? And, you know, it's Damien's job, amongst others, to translate that into sort of protective laws. But what I was listening and interested in during the conversation so far is perhaps the risk that there is a disconnect between what is going on about setting new behaviors and regulations particularly for the tech companies, because obviously they are in the main, the sort of firing line, in the main sights of any legislation. Although, as we know, increasingly all kinds of companies are using technology. So it's not just about the, you know, the usual suspects, the Googles, the Facebooks, whoever. You know, so there's that kind of legislative envelope that's going on with them. But I would be concerned if it isn't somehow, if the dots are not joined with lots of other initiatives, framework, normative frameworks that are going on. Peter mentioned the SDGs, and certainly business and human rights, I think, is an interesting comparison, really, because what you had there is the UN guiding principles, which are now 10 years old, Three pillars, you know, it's government's duty to protect human rights, but business has a responsibility. And then the third pillar is the access to remedy, which is sort of like the civil society, where the civil society action and redress and accountability is nested. And that third pillar is generally acknowledged to be the weakest in terms of how it's been implemented. So the kind of accountability functions and following through on any legislation, I think needs to learn lessons, certainly from that debate in business and human rights, and to say to join some dots there. And as Peter mentioned, I think it's really important, you know, the digital space isn't explicitly mentioned in the SDGs. I mean, you have decent work and you have all sorts of other goals and aspirations. The SDGs were drawn up, what, where are we now, 2022? They were drawn up sort of 10, 15 years ago. This is such a fast moving kind of emerging landscape that one has to worry and be concerned that unless we draw lessons from these previous debates, unless we really root legislation and the norm setting of regulations in some of these other frameworks and these other experiences, then it will just end up going down an alley. And I'm afraid that, you know, powerful companies, particularly the tech ones, can get round any regulations in the end, because this is a global landscape. Damien's talking about national legislation. There is European legislation, but it's the old problem of how do you regulate from a national standpoint or even a regional standpoint, stuff that's happening, business operations that know no borders.
Thanks, Mary.
Maybe I can come in on that. You can. You clearly can. There's one example on the globe that demonstrates you can, and that is China. China has effectively created its own digital space. So there is, and for very specific reasons of governance, they utilize digital means to create governance and control. There is no success for Google or Facebook or WhatsApp in China. They did that. They created sort of a protectionist border around the internet in China. And they decided that is fundamentally against every principle that governs the internet. The internet was created to create basically a flat environment for people to exchange across the globe. But of course, a government can decide to put up a border on the internet, rendering it effectively useless if your market is too small. If you're as big as China is, you can do that and still have a thriving economy and make good use of the data you accumulate there. What I'm afraid more is that, and that goes back to something you mentioned, Mary, that we allow not governments, but global companies to create these closed off environments, very much to what Damien described with Meta having their own currency and suddenly not only creating an artificial world, but also creating an artificial economy that is set apart from the real economy, where probably it's not even paying the taxes that the people that spend money there normally would have to pay. So it's really creating an alternate reality, not only in the experience kind of way, but also in the way of escaping certain areas of legislation. So it really, I think it is one of the biggest challenges for legislators to try to get a handle on this and create an online regulatory environment that sort of mirrors the safe and functional reality that we have in our offline world. But that is a particular challenge.
I wonder if I could come back in there and, oh, sorry, Damien, over to you.
Yes, I mean, there are, ultimately the companies have to abide by the laws in the different countries where they trade. And you can see one area where they voluntarily do that, and that's on the licensing of content. Now, if you're a Netflix customer, and you're watching Netflix on your laptop and you get moved from Germany to France to the UK, you'll find as you make those journeys that the programs that are available to you change, because the platforms have got a licensing agreement with the copyright holder, and that's sold on a country by country basis. And amazingly, seamlessly, they can enforce that. So the technology is absolutely there to create different user experiences in different geographic territories. Legislation has been created in different countries, not just in China, which is enforced. So Australia, even, you know, country the size of Australia, you know, achieved what it wanted in its standoff with Facebook over compensation for news content in that country, which Facebook, you know, decided to abide by the law in that country. Germany has different hate speech laws to the rest of Europe, and it enforces liability on the platforms for removing content that breaches those hate speech laws. Now, some might question how effective the companies truly are at doing that, but nevertheless, they've had to do it. So you can legislate by territory, and the companies have to try and comply with the laws there. And we do it happens already in terms of data protection law as well, where action is taken by different national regulators using data protection law. The other thing you could flip around is look at this. What if we approach this in the way that we do with financial fraud and crimes? So America has the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. You know, the UK has the Bribery Act. So those mean that an offence committed by a British national or British company, in the case of America, even in the dollar currency, anywhere in the world, can be prosecuted in courts in America. Now, what if we said that in tech, which is, say, to platforms that are headquartered in the EU or the UK or America, and said, OK, if your platforms, are with your knowledge, are engaged in supporting activity anywhere in the world, which would be illegal here, then you will be liable for it in courts in this country. That would be a very interesting way of looking at this. And that's something that already exists in the financial sector.
Yeah, but who would win that debate would be China, because through the Belt and Road Initiative, you know, they have a ready set of markets that they are forcing, you know, their tech and their app suite, kind of their digital suite onto. And so you would end up with a situation where most countries in the world have to follow Chinese law when it comes to how you deal with tech. Those laws would not be, you know, based in any human rights norms, I can guarantee that. And that's the danger that we're trying to avoid. I take your point. You know, you can force, you know, even these big bad tech companies to conform to your laws if your market is big enough. But, you know, I think we can look at things like pharmaceutical regulation and see that it took decades, right, to get back to a place where we had some sort of balance of equities, you know, so people could actually access medicines they needed at a decent price. And, you know, there are a lot of pitfalls, I think, from IP licensing. You mentioned copyright, that we should learn from, so it does not become, you know, again, those major markets having their way. And, you know, in my work, you know, we look at places where, you know, the regulators are all too happy to force these tech companies to bend to their whims. And in Russia recently, it was, you know, demands to take Navalny's smart voting app off the app stores, and for Apple and Google both complied. And I think we can all agree on this call, right, that that's not the kind of, you know, smart regulation that we want to see in the world. And that's not how we think tech should be governed, in ways that actually reduce the free flow of information, you know, that we've come to expect in the offline world, right? And so, you know, I think it is a bit more complicated than simply saying, you know, we can and will regulate, and companies should follow these laws, right, wherever they want to operate or offer their services.
I don't see why we can't do that. And we can't, there's not very much we can do about the rules that the Chinese state require companies to follow in China, and whether those companies choose to comply. I mean, but I think if, you know, if you take the point I was making about responsibility of what happens around the world, you know, if you could say, well, we know there was, you know, we know there was genocidal actions carried out against the Rohingya people, and there's a court, someone bring a court case against Facebook for that. If you could say, well, okay, well, we could see the company clearly had knowledge and information about that, people knew about it. Therefore, should they have some liability, not just in that region, but in their home country as well? I mean, that's how the Bribery Act works in the UK. It's how the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. So But the question I was posing really was, it's not a question of how our laws are enforced in different countries around the world where we have no jurisdiction, but what sort of regulations could be enforced against companies that are based within our jurisdiction, but we're talking about their activities elsewhere in the world. And I think, you know, I said that already exists in other sectors, and therefore I think it's not an illegitimate question to ask about the tech sector as well.
Can I just bring us perhaps slightly back to this idea of the multi-stakeholder collaboration kind of spaces that the report focuses on, where indeed these kinds of digital dynamics, let's say, are going to play out in the context of a very concrete challenge that may or may not involve people who, you know, as Peter was saying, are invisible online, who may or may not have the kinds of voice that Stephanie was saying earlier, you know, businesses have to take notice of. I think what's really interesting is that when we talk about these very broad global regulatory contexts and initiatives, they are both powerful, but also very much dependent on where they're being implemented and rolled out, who wants to take notice of them and who doesn't. And in some of these multi-stakeholder, you know, in fragile and conflict zones, for example, you know, there's no guarantee that there's an effective government who can make legislation that people will take notice of in those kinds of spaces. Mary, you know, the report is focused on this multi-stakeholder collaboration. There's lots of challenging ideas about how business organisations, whether they're very small local ones or whether they are these kind of, you know, much bigger multinationals who kind of might come in and say, let's go and track data and do an Ebola mapping exercise, how they kind of engage with these much more difficult and complicated environments in order to solve very difficult problems on the ground. I don't know if you want to reflect on some of the things that have been said to kind of bring those, we're just in the last 10 minutes or so of the discussion, to bring those things back together.
Yeah, thank you. It just to begin with a point that I was trying to say before, that I think the follow through, whether you start with legislation or some kind of even social activism that brings about change, the follow through, and that what we'd seen in the case of business and human rights is that holding people to account and enforcing your new norms is problematic. I think I was working a lot on business and human rights at the time of the Bribery and Corruption Act, and we all thought this is marvelous, this is a game changer. But I don't think there's been a single prosecution under it, because it's just very difficult to do. So that's what gives one pause for thought. And what we tried to do when we were looking at this whole conundrum of how do you get, whether it's in tech or any other kind of business activity, how do you get businesses, A, to behave in a different way, and to sort of to put themselves forward and collaborate with other stakeholders, you can go down the route of which is what business and human rights has tried to do, whether or not it's sort of mandatory, which at the moment it's clearly not. You can try and force people to change. You can try and, you know, as it were, impose, ram through new norms. But our experience, certainly with big companies, and clearly in the tech sector, we're talking about some very big companies, as somebody mentioned before, that they will find ways around it. You know, we still have tax havens that I find astonishing. So companies don't pay taxes. So in order to, I think where we came at it from was, in order to avoid that kind of clash of wills and confrontation, could you go at it in a different way? Could you have a conversation that started from a different point of view? And really for us, writing this report and doing the research with the UN, it was about changing the terms of the conversation so that you got all these different stakeholders, whether it was companies, governments, communities, individuals, to come together and talk about, you know, where was their common ground between them? I mean, it's a bit of a cliche, but where is the win-win, rather than everybody trying to extract something from it? And could this sort of strange, not strange idea, but perhaps a strange term, but this idea of human security and everybody's well-being, everybody's safety, which also creates a better business environment, by the way. And I think that's increasingly what companies are realizing, that there is common ground there, that for the business to survive, individuals, whether they are purchasers of tech products, users of different kinds of technology, or whether it's soap powder, that if you get better business out of considering the impact of your operations on them. And I suppose I would go then back to something that Stefan was talking about, which I think is hugely important, is this, again, perhaps as nebulous as the idea of human security, is trust. How do you get relationships around any kind of business activity, any kind of political activity, indeed, that aren't about coercing people, aren't about threatening them with, you know, prosecution if you don't do this, or fines which really don't get levied or certainly don't get paid, or just, you know, deal a glancing blow to very big companies? How do you perhaps turn that round and start to build that culture of co-construction, co-creation? How do you bake trust back into these processes? And I think with tech, it's hugely important. I mean, we've seen the erosion of trust in politics, and Stefan mentioned, you know, how badly politics, governments fare compared to, as perhaps surprisingly, compared to business. I used to be a journalist, and, you know, we were always told that the least trusted person in the room was, you know, after a politician was the journalist. So I think this idea of how do you get processes, how do you start to have conversations where this innate distrust, which is so corrosive of collective problem solving, is so corrosive in our societies, how do you start to fix that? That's a, I know, huge problem, but perhaps there's something in everybody's experience, whether it's Damien, Stefan or Peter's, that can start to go down that avenue.
Stefan, would you like to respond?
Yeah, I since we just recently launched a 2022 trust barometer, I think I'm perfectly happy to talk about this, because there are some, the barometer is this time headlined by, it's called the cycle of distrust. And actually that fits quite well within the multi-stakeholder approach discussion, because the cycle of distrust encompasses basically business, NGOs, governments, and media. So that these entities that are all need to be trusted in some respect to have a stable and thriving society are currently all under threat. All of them have been losing trust. Some have been losing trust more, so government and media, but that, I mean, we have to be realistic, is partly a fallout of the COVID crisis. So the COVID situation has aggravated the situation, but it's astonishing. For me, actually, the astonishing thing really was that people are now looking to businesses, to their employers. So their employer communication is more trusted than the newspaper they actually pay for. That shouldn't be. I used to be a journalist myself as much as Mary, and I'm quite frustrated by that reality. So we really, I think there needs to be a very broad approach from legislators, from media, and also from civil society to strengthen, let's say, solid reporting and information again. Because currently people will trust their neighbor or their employer more than the government or the newspaper. And that is unhealthy. We need to change that. We need to work on that. And I think there are ways, but first you need to acknowledge the reality, and then you need to start to work on, let's say, the little bits and pieces in all parts. It's not one screw that you can screw in. It's really a more complex environment that you need to operate. But I think Damien wanted to come in on this.
Firstly, just on what Stefan said, I mean, and I think that problem has got worse, and I personally believe that social media has accelerated that that process. I'm not saying that journalists and politicians have ever been universally popular, but the insidious nature of disinformation is that it leaves people not necessarily believing alternative realities, but not knowing what to believe. You know, we've seen in populist political regimes concerted efforts to undermine trusted media and again, so that people are more reliant on even just so that they disregard any criticism of governments that may come from an independent media. And I think the fact that in Europe, there's very interesting research looking at vaccine hesitancy in different European countries. And that only really started to go down once people were being vaccinated. But over half of people in France said they wouldn't take the vaccine. Even in Germany and the UK, it was about 50-50. That's all been, when something new comes along and you see those sorts of results, that's being driven by, you know, doubt that's being sowed in people's minds. And I think social media has played a role in that. I think it would have been possible to think about the rise of conspiracy networks like QAnon without rise so quickly without internet channels to do it. So that is a big problem. It's one of the reasons why I think we should take these things very seriously, not because it's not just about user safety in tech, it's about the destabilizing democracy as we've known it. And I think left unchecked, these problems will get worse. I mean, to Mary's point earlier on about ways in which we can try and build more collaboration and trust in, I think it depends on the intentions of the companies themselves. There's the great example in the 60s of the Ford Pinto car, which if you drove into the back of it, at a certain speed, the engine blew up. And what was discovered, you know, a memo extracted somehow from Ford in the late 60s showed that Ford had decided internally that it was cheaper to pay out compensation to people whose cars blew up than it was to recall the entire fleet. And I think in tech, what we've seen from whistleblower disclosures is information from within the companies is quite important about understanding the balance between engagement with the platform and user safety, where the companies have made decisions favoring engagement over safety, you know, within a closed environment where no one's able to question that. And so I think transparency can play a role, and the role in the online safety regime of the regulator is important, not just in assessing whether offences have been committed and issuing fines, but actually having the power to produce real transparency reports. And I actually think companies, you know, can sometimes be, if there's the risk of public shaming, companies can make better decisions. But I'm afraid, when we talk about big industries, if there's no realistic prospect of embarrassing information being disclosed to the public and therefore having a reputation on the company, and there's no obligation in law to behave in a certain way, companies historically have been loath to do things that are going to cost them more, where they've got to spend more money to make less money. And the only times they tend to do that is actually to avoid public shaming, you know, that they do it. So I think, you know, transparency, if you can make it work, can play a role.
Thanks, Damien. Peter?
Thank you. Yeah. A lot to agree with. And just to say, I think on... To highlight, I think a lot of governments we see, you know, on one side are resorting to sanctions, you know, unilateral, multilateral sanctions, more targeted sanctions, as, you know, one of the only tools in the toolbox left that works when addressing conflict environments, whether it's Afghanistan or Myanmar, you know, and coming from civil society, where we see the harmful impacts of overcompliance with sanctions, of, you know, legacies of bad state policy, you know, we don't like that state of affairs, that we are left, you know, talking to policymakers about how they can, you know, take certain individuals offline or off, you know, certain institutions out. And on the other hand, you know, we see a lot of governments resorting to kind of policymaking through hostage taking, you know, threatening to shut down entire platforms, Nigeria, Russia, et cetera. And that too, you know, is not a healthy or sustainable way forward. So what we do at Access Now to help build trust is two main things. I think one is our RightsCon convening series is the big tent event series that we just got, you know, I think almost a record number, 1,200 or so applications contribute to the program of that event, which is in June. And it also brings, you know, pretty much all the major tech platforms are redoubling their investment in things like RightsCon and in human rights due diligence, consultation and co-creation, with civil society, and I assume so also with, you know, if not every government, at least those in, you know, to Damien's point, where they see their major markets and interests lie. And I think so those discussions are happening, they're becoming more robust, and they need to be structured, right, to be more sustainable, to prevent that feedback fatigue. And that's where contributions like from academia, like we've gotten, are really key. And then, you know, the other place we can build trust is on a more individual level. And we do that through our digital security helpline, providing kind of an intermediary, an interface, really a human response, like people don't get from the platforms by and large. You know, we try to process, you know, we've gotten a record number of requests for support from broad cross-section, from journalists to bloggers to activists and human rights defenders. And I think that the tech companies need to see us as a gap filler. They need to see this remedial processing as a workaround, a band-aid that's actually just, I think as others have said, allowing them to continue their operations despite this kind of gaping wound. And I think there's a lot to learn by the tech sector from civil society. And hopefully policymakers can find ways to mandate absolutely, you know, more robust transparency reports, including on, you know, their own remedial processes and appeals programs that these tech companies offer, you know, who's using the seatbelts and are they working, sort of thing. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Peter, and thanks to all of the panelists for the discussion this evening, which is really fascinating and has been incredibly useful, I think, for thinking through this kind of idea of how and where we use the digital in these very complex contexts. Lots of ideas in the discussion relate exactly to the kind of scenarios that are in the report, that fundamental reality of needing to share power across multiple groups of people, across multiple types of organisations, developing the foundations like trust and like these levers that you can use to prompt people to behave in different ways, regulation and other norms. And then also, you know, the processes, the transparency, the recognition that there are difficult conversations, that these things take time, that the digital is always vulnerable then also to weaponization as well as to being used as a productive tool, and that kind of, you know, fragility of the digital perhaps as well as something that one might talk about in future conversations. But thank you all so much. Thanks to the audience for joining us tonight. Just a last reminder that there is another LSE Ideas event on Thursday, which you may be interested in, related to the cyber norms, transnational efforts to regulate cyberspace. And there's just a single speaker at that event, Kaya Chidlik, who is the Senior Director of Digital Diplomacy at Microsoft. And that's from 4 to 5 p.m. UK time, also run by LSE Ideas, as I say. But thanks, everyone, very much for participating, and we look forward to seeing you at another event soon.